turn of the 1900s, they were just beginning to figure out how to measure the proton concentration. Glass electrodes had to be hand-blown in the laboratory. They couldn't go and purchase it. And that lasted until 1930s. Chemical equilibria was understood in, what was it, late 1880s. So they were just 15, 20 years into it. That's right.
Okay,
the next speaker is on Langmuir's World by Roger Summerhayes. He's the guest speaker for me, I think, and for all of us. And come on. Also, the grandson of Irvin Langmuir, so he has a lot of personal family photos.
Secrets,
yes.
Thank you, sir. Can you show me how to navigate forward and back?
Forward, back.
Oh, very good.
And then this mouse, okay. If you need it.
Very good.
Okay.
Good morning, everyone. I'm very grateful to the American Society of Agronomy for this special invitation and the opportunity to talk to you. In particular, of course, Professor Christian Schultes, who found me where I live in St. Croix in the U.S. Virgin Islands. It is there that I teach high school chemistry, a little bit of physics, and also karate as well. So no one should disagree with me about anything. What I hope to deliver today is just the highlights of my grandfather's life. He had such a prolific career that it precludes me from going into much detail. So I'm going to skip entire sections of his life just because of the constraints of time. You should know that I never really knew my grandfather. He died just shy of my first birthday. I've been told about his Nobel Prize, of course, but at a young age, I thought earning a Nobel Prize was something akin to winning a science fair, perhaps. It was only years later when I read more about him and I started to examine his library of 16-millimeter films that I decided to tell the story of his rich life in a documentary that I made called Langmuir's World, which will be screened later. So let's get straight to the man and see what made him special. So, an insatiable curiosity. He was absolutely fascinated with natural phenomena. He couldn't stop looking at things and thinking about things. He was, of course, brilliant. They don't hand out Nobel Prizes when I last checked. And he was also a very enthusiastic and infectious teacher. When I made the film about him, I had to link into a sort of old boys network of scientists who actually knew and worked with my grandfather. And you could tell that they had been infected by Langmuir. He would just absolutely stimulated people with his interest and passed on that enthusiasm to him. And the other thing about Langmuir that you should know, he had this tremendous love of the outdoors. He was very much into walking, hiking, camping, mountaineering, downhill skiing, conservation efforts. So these are the key themes that established much of what he did in his life. So we'll start the chronology of his life, if you will. Just finishing university. He graduated from Columbia University School of Mines, 1903, a degree in metallurgy. And he actually chose metallurgy because it mixed chemistry, physics, and mathematics so well. And he adored all three, so he wanted all three. He didn't want to become too narrow too soon. He was looking to pursue his PhD next, and there was only one place to do that at the time, and that was in Germany. he weighed Leipzig versus Göttingen, and he eventually chose Göttingen because there were fewer Americans there. He said there was something on the order of 1,000 Americans studying in Leipzig at the time, and he really wanted the German experience. And he was also very impressed with Nernst. He sat in on some lectures. He sort of learned German as he went along, and that's what he wanted to do. But he was very, very impressed with how Nernst was so lucid in his lectures. So he was looking forward to studying in Göttingen. His research that he was directed to follow by Nernst was the behavior of gases around filaments. And at the time, Nernst was using platinum filaments. This all suited Langmuir just fine. And initially, he really, really enjoyed the research. It was absolutely fascinating to him, learning lots of things. But gradually, he became a little disappointed with Nernst because Nernst wasn't paying enough attention to him. And this may be just a bratty graduate student feeling that he's being neglected. Because let's face it, Nernst had a few other things on his mind. For example, he was developing the third law of thermodynamics. But the other thing that really annoyed Langmuir was Nernst had a habit of coming through the lab fairly frequently and uttering in German, "Haben Sie nur Zahlen?" I don't know how many of you speak German, but I don't. So what this means is, do you have results for me? Do you have numbers? Do you have data? And he would sort of badger his students. And this setup, studying the gases, was not an easy one. The logistics of setting up and measuring the gases was quite difficult and time-consuming. And Langmuir was annoyed by this. And fortunately, he ended up in a position where people stopped annoying him. But lest you think Langmuir was just a lab rat, you should know that he loved outdoor activities, and that, of course, kept him in phenomenal physical shape. So he might be hiking Germany's highest peak just for fun and no preparation. Or he might walk 50 miles with a friend from Göttingen into Brocken in the Harz Mountains. And one hobby that he started to pursue was brand new to him, and actually to many of the people in Germany. He'd heard about these things called Norwegian snowshoes. So he ordered a pair. They, of course, were what we know now as skis. And he taught himself to downhill ski just by walking to the nearest slope and finding some snow and clawing his way up and then sliding down and falling a lot. And he absolutely came to love this sport, and he would share it with his fellow grad students and teach them if they were willing to fall down with him as well. And here's a wonderful postcard from 1905. I don't think any of these photos contain him. I think it's sort of a generic postcard. But if you look at the signatures at the bottom, you can see Langmuir's is over on the left, highlighted, and a few friends, and you can see that they're enjoying skiing in the Harz Mountains. After he earned his PhD, the big question in his mind, of course, was academics or industry? And his brother wrote a very influential letter to him saying that he should stick with pure research. And as a result, he moved back to the New York area where his family was from. And he taught at Stevens Institute of Technology in Hoboken for 3 years. And it should have been the perfect job, but unfortunately it wasn't. What he gradually figured out is that there are apathetic students out there. I know you can. It's difficult to imagine. It's hard for me to imagine that when I walk into a classroom, students aren't fascinated by my every word. But there were apathetic students. The pay also was low. And perhaps the thing that really irked Langmuir the most was the fact that he didn't have enough time for his own research. And so he made a move. 3 years later, he made a move to the General Electric Corporation, and specifically the research lab in 1909 in Schenectady, New York, where I was brought up. And if you look at the center of the picture, that's Langmuir in the back. And then the gentleman to the lower right is Willis Whitney. He was the director of the lab. And the gentleman looking over Whitney's shoulder is a man named William Coolidge, who had just succeeded the year before in making the element tungsten ductile. And as a result, it was possible to use tungsten as a filament in what used to be Edison's lamp, which used carbon filaments. A bit about Whitney. He was educated at MIT and also a PhD in Germany. And he'd been given a directive by the company to pursue really pure research. So his philosophy was, and he had the latitude to do this, fortunately, was to pick great people, top graduate students, top people in the industry, and just set them free. The guidelines were very, very loose. And by loose, I mean he truly would walk through the lab, and instead of saying, "Do you have new results for me?" he would truly say, he's quoted many times as saying this, "Are you having fun?" Which is, of course, the antithesis of Haben Sie nun Zeit. And as long as the scientists were staying relatively on task, and as long as they were entertained, he knew that the discoveries would come. So he was a firm believer in serendipity as well. And this became another theme for Langmuir's life. And Langmuir actually defined it in his own terms in one of the final papers that he wrote. And Langmuir defined it as the art of profiting from the unexpected. And the notion is very simple. Oftentimes in science, we set out a problem, we're working in a certain direction, but what you need to do is you can't put blinders on. If the blinders are too tight, then what will happen is you will miss what's going on the side streets. And sometimes when you pass something and it's vaguely interesting, you've got to let it distract you. And you've got to let it carry you down that path, and eventually you may discover something far more interesting than the original problem that you were working towards. So Langmuir was a firm believer in this, as was Whitney. I prefer the layman's definition, which is looking for a needle in the haystack and finding the farmer's daughter instead. So he loved the freedom of working at General Electric, but he actually began to feel guilty about it because he wasn't discovering anything. He was fascinated by the research, but he went to Langmuir one day and he said, "Listen, I'm having a ball, no doubt, but I don't know what good this is to the General Electric Company." And Whitney actually said to him, "That's not your problem, that's mine." And he kept hands off. The general problem that Langmuir was working on, which I alluded to before, was the fact that even though they'd made tungsten filaments replace the carbon filaments, they were burning out too soon. And very often the incandescent bulbs were getting very black inside as well. And they had no idea why this was happening. The conventional wisdom was there were contaminants inside the light bulb, probably gases, and the notion was you were getting oxidation on the tungsten, weakening the tungsten, and then it would fail. So obviously the solution was you had to produce a better vacuum. You had to remove those contaminants. And they had very good vacuum pumps at General Electric, but Langer took a different approach. And this was one of the times that Whitney was actually sort of, you're going to do what? So Langer decided, if contaminants are the enemy, I want to get to know my enemy. So what he did was just the opposite. Instead of trying to improve the vacuum, he actually pumped in all different kinds of gases to see exactly how they would interact with the film. So he flooded the light bulb with a bunch of different gases. He used water vapor, he used mercury vapor, oxygen, nitrogen, he tried all these gases, and he got all kinds of different effects. And he noticed the odd behavior of one gas in particular, hydrogen. Now, speaking of odd behavior, we have to discuss the mustache just for a moment. This was an unfortunate choice, I believe, but fortunately it disappeared within the year. One of the mysterious behaviors that Langer noticed with hydrogen was that it was eating up energy. You put in lots and lots of energy to heat up the filament, and the energy seemed to be disappearing. And so Langer hypothesized that there was some sort of endothermic reaction going on. And he figured out that actually molecular hydrogen was being dissociated into atomic hydrogen. But then there was another strange effect as well. The pressure inside the light bulb, the gas pressure, was plummeting. And he was mystified by this. And he said, well, this atomic hydrogen has to be going somewhere. And where it was going was onto the inside surface of the glass light bulb and as a monatomic layer. And he figured out that it was a monatomic layer simply because sooner or later the surface of the inside of the light bulb would become saturated, just like you can only fit so many checker pieces on a checkerboard. And then once that was done, then the pressure would rise again. So that's why he hypothesized the monatomic layer. This, of course, was one of the seeds of what became known as surface chemistry. And in 1985, American Chemical Society contacted my family and asked permission to name the journal for surface chemistry after my grandfather. Of course, that was a tremendous honor. This also anticipates the Langer equation as well. So, eventually, after about 3 years, Langer came up with the solution to the light bulb problem. He said, instead of trying to remove the contaminants, let's dilute the heck out of them. So he filled the light bulb he tried nitrogen and argon, they both worked well. And remember, argon had only been recently discovered. And what that did, it simply diluted the contaminants so much that any of the side reactions became negligible. And it significantly lengthened the life of the light bulb, and as a result he was given the patent in 1912 for the creation of the gas-filled incandescent lamp. This saved the world millions of dollars a night because this light bulb was so efficient. This discovery sealed Langer's fate. He knew that he wanted to be at GE for the rest of his life, and also because of the monumental nature of the discovery, they felt secure that other things would follow from Langer. So Whitney had complete faith in him after this discovery. Now, switching to life out of doors for a minute, we have to talk about one of Langer's best friends. Oh, I skipped a slide. There's some guy named Thomas Edison who came to visit 10 years later and was fascinated by the improvements to the light bulb that Langer had made. And talking about serendipity, a quick story about making my movie. this, the discovery of the film, the motion picture film of this, was very serendipitous for me. I was walking through the GE archives with a librarian, and we were walking to look at some paperwork, and I happened to glance as we were walking through, and there was a can of film, can of 16 millimeter motion picture film, sitting on the floor with this scratched out label that you could barely read that said Langmuir Surface Chemistry. And I said, "What's that?" And of course, a lot of that is used in my documentary. So, on to Langmuir's colleagues outside the lab. This man was named John Apperson. He worked as an engineer at General Electric. And very avid outdoorsman, again, hiking, camping, mountaineering, and most of all, conservation efforts. And he drew Langmuir into that world, and he introduced Langmuir to most important Lake George, which is about 60 miles north of Schenectady. And they got into a lot of trouble together up in Lake George, which we'll talk about as well. Another lifelong companion was the woman whom he married, Marion Mercereau. And while she had a good pedigree, if you will, he would not be satisfied with marrying just some society woman. She, of course, had to put up with all his outdoor interests and was an enthusiastic hiker and camper and so forth. And one of my favorite pictures of them is here they are canoeing together. And first of all, I love the fact that they're both wearing ties, very formally dressed. So there they are canoeing on Lake George. And if you notice, that canoe is sitting very low in the water. And the reason is, it's filled with rocks. And what they were doing clearly was an Apperson project. What they used to do is they would go to the shore and gather huge boulders, as big as they could carry, load them into canoes, and then take them to the islands, and there are 170 on Lake George, and stack them around the edge to build up the shoreline. This was called riprapping to prevent erosion. So that presumably was a very good date. All right, back to the scientific world. We're going to talk about a different chemist for a moment, Gilbert Lewis. Langmuir had met him 8 years before, but in 1916, Lewis published a pivotal paper called The Atom and the Molecule, where he really made key insights into discovering the nature of chemical bonding. Of course, this is invaluable in organic chemistry. And Lewis's view of the atom was quite different from the physicists at the time. And of course, 1916, you know, you're thinking about Rutherford's discoveries in 1910, Bohr's discoveries in 1913. And Lewis had a completely different vision of what the atom was about. And he came up with what we call the cubicle model of the atom. And as a chemist, he really didn't care what was going on the inside. He didn't care about the structure of the nucleus and maybe what the inner electron shells were doing. He was interested in the valence electrons. And he sensed that there was something special about the number 8. And a cube has 8 vertices, so why not play around with cubes? So he started to envision chemical bonding along these lines. Now, later on that year, Lewis and Langmuir met again. Columbia University was having a symposium. And they hit it off once again. And Langmuir was badgering Lewis about this paper. He just thought it was fascinating, very insightful. And so they discussed it for several days. There was another symposium at City College, and Langmuir badgered him at that one, and then they actually met for lunch at the Harvard Club the next day. And Langmuir knew that he was going to take this idea and build upon it. Oh, by the way, I should mention that Langmuir presented a small paper at the symposium, which included something we call the Langmuir equation. All I will say about this equation is happy 100th birthday, and I will allow the far more learned at this conference to discuss its merits and its limitations. Langer didn't do anything with his ideas that he gained from Lewis right away. Instead, he went back to the lab, and of course, we're in the middle of World War I, and Langer developed one of the early forms of sonar. Of course, U-boats, German U-boats, were a tremendous problem, sinking Allied ships left and right crossing the Atlantic. And once this sonar was developed, we were able to see U-boats and much more easily defeat them. But eventually, the war was winding down, and General Electric had a very prestigious visitor, Ernest Rutherford, came to town, and Langmuir got to host him. And of course, conversation turned to atomic theory. And Ernest Rutherford, of course, with his famous gold foil experiment, figuring out that the positive charge was concentrated in a nucleus in the atom. But he was very interested in what Langmuir's ideas and Lewis's ideas. But he sensed that Langmuir was taking Lewis's ideas a lot farther. And so as a result, he urged Langmuir to publish right away. And so Langmuir did. His vision was slightly different from Lewis's. Instead of the cubical atom, he visualized concentric electron shells, spheres. But even in his paper, he said, I don't really care what exactly is going on with the electrons. They could be oscillating, they could be orbiting, they could be dancing up and down, jumping levels. I don't care. All I care about is the chemical bonding. And building on Lewis's ideas, he actually coined the terms both octet theory, and not many people know this, but he was the original person to use the term covalent bond as well. And I always emphasize that to my chemistry students. And eventually, the Lewis and the Langmuir atom abandoned sort of the cubical view and the concentric shell view and ended up with the modern view, which is just simply electron dot notation. Forget about the cubes, forget about the spheres. Just put the electrons together until you get 8, and that explains tens of millions of compounds. Very simple idea. Profound implications. Now, this paper that Langmuir published in 1919 was tremendously successful. It was just like wildfire, and he was asked to deliver it really multiple days in multiple different cities, and his career as a speaker kind of took off. He was very charismatic, very clear, and this brings me to the fact that not only did he build on Lewis's ideas, but he presented them a little better. And it wasn't just sizzle that he was adding to Lewis's ideas, but he was adding some steak too. But it brings up the point that if you come up with a valuable insight, you have to be able to share it. You have to be able to go to conferences. You have to be able to put yourself out there and communicate your ideas and not just publish and sit back and wait for success to knock on your door. You've got to put yourself out there somewhere. And Lewis was not very good at doing that. He was a West Coast chemist, University of California. And while he had a very dedicated team of graduate students whom he worked with, he didn't sell his ideas as well as Langmuir did. And Lewis was a scientist who probably deserved the Nobel Prize but never received it. And it may have been partially because of that. ...1923 was a big year for Irving Langmuir. Here you see J.J. Thomson, the discoverer of the electron in 1897, visiting. And there again is Langmuir's colleague, William Coolidge. Coolidge went on, of course, with all this talk of glass cathode ray tubes. He greatly improved the X-ray tube, made it much better, much more effective than Rentgen had ever visualized. Fortunately, also in 1923, Langmuir started shooting black and white home movies. and I still have this camera, and it still works. It's spring-driven, you just wind it up and shoot. And if you replace the lenses, and if you can find 16mm film, you can still make home movies with it. Also in 1923, Langmuir went to a talk in Amherst, Massachusetts, given by the famous physicist Niels Bohr. And they hit it off immediately. They used to say about Langmuir, he either had 5 minutes for you or 5 hours for you. If you were simply coming in and saying, oh, you're a famous scientist, can I get my picture taken with you? Then he had 5 minutes for you. But if you wanted to come in and talk turkey, if you want to discuss something scientific and really roll up your sleeves and get your hands dirty, then he would drop everything and spend as much time with you as necessary. So, of course, they had to spend more time together. So Langmuir drags Bohr back to Schenectady to show him the GE research lab. And Niels Bohr was absolutely fascinated with this. And they became lifelong friends as a result, good friends. And Langmuir often said, Bohr was the scientist that I most admire in the world. In 1927, Langmuir's traveling abroad to deliver some papers and, of course, get in some downhill skiing in Switzerland. And it was an extraordinarily rough trip. The seas were absolutely wild. And while most of the crew and the passengers were below decks, very busy being seasick, Langmuir, of course, was on deck with the movie camera shooting film of the waves, because he was absolutely fascinated with ocean waves. Unfortunately, he slipped and he broke his foot. And that, of course, altered his European itinerary significantly. But once again, serendipity came to his rescue. And he ended up here at perhaps the greatest meeting of physicists in the 20th century. This is the Solvay Congress. And of course, it's filled with Nobel Prize winners. And I have a trivia question for the group. Which person is the only one who won 2 Nobel Prizes? Does anyone know? Very good. Marie Curie. All my students say Einstein. It was Einstein. No, it wasn't Einstein. It was the only woman in the group. It was that, exactly. So well done, ladies. Well done. That's just a who's who of physics. In the back row, you see Heisenberg and Pauli, and then the fellow with the glasses is Schrodinger. And then the second row, there's Niels Bohr, there's Max Born, there's Paul Dirac. And then down in front, in center, Einstein, of course, Lorentz, Marie Curie, then Max Planck. And then the fellow on the right, or on the far left with the cane, is Erwin Langmuir. And of course, he had the cane because he was still nursing that that broken foot. But this never would have happened if he hadn't broken his foot. He felt a bit awkward at this conference because it was, of course, invitation only, and he saw himself as more a chemist than a physicist. But he was absolutely fascinated, and he could yammer away with them in German or French. And I can spend half an hour on this slide. I will not. But perhaps the most significant new thing that was introduced at the conference was the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. And it was by that punk kid in the back row who was in his mid-20s. I mean, look at all the gray hair in that picture, and who comes up with the innovative idea? Heisenberg did. And Langmuir actually wrote a letter back to Schenectady, wrote a letter back to Whitney at the research lab, and said, you know, this, I follow the mathematics. Heisenberg, I think he's got it. I think this is right, but it's very queer. Just he sensed its strangeness. Of course, Einstein found the idea just unacceptable. His famous quotation, God does not play dice. He said over and over again at the conference, because the idea that fundamentally matter was behaving probabilistically instead of in a certain fashion involving cause and effect, just Einstein couldn't accept that. Bohr, later on in the conference, finally turned to Einstein and said, "Einstein, stop telling God what to do." On his return to the United States, Langer was elected president of the American Chemical Society. And a few months later, the stock market crashed. I assume this is coincidental, not causal. 1932, Langer chooses a new assistant to work with him in the lab, a man named Vincent Schaefer. Fascinating background. This young man quit high school because his parents became ill and he had to support them. So he went to GE, he worked as a machinist, and he quickly gained a reputation around the lab as being able to build anything. So the scientists, who would have a vague idea of, well, you need to test so-and-so, but I don't have any idea of what the apparatus should be. Vincent Schaefer could figure out what it should be, and then he could build it. Very talented young man. And also a great lover of the outdoors, loved downhill skiing and conservation efforts, so he and Langer became thick as thieves. But this was a controversial decision because there were a lot of guys with better academic qualifications and experience at GE who got stepped over. So this punk kid got hired. 1932, November, Langer finally earns a Nobel Prize in chemistry for his work in surface chemistry. Here's a fun picture. This appeared in Life magazine of Langer actually receiving the award from King Gustav. And then after this, of course, a series of honors followed. This is one of my favorite pictures. I just discovered this 2 years ago. 100th anniversary celebration of the Nobel Prize. And so they're meeting in New York City, and there on the left, Sinclair Lewis, and a former Secretary of State, and then Einstein and Langer. And of course, you know that Einstein and Langer were just jawing away in German. And then Langer's world tour begins. And one of the places that he went was Kawasaki, Japan, delivered the Iwadere lecture, and wonderful photographs from this visit. And this is one of my favorites. This appeared on a postcard that his wife Marion, who's seated next to him, sent home. And I love the level of formality and service there. But there's Langer mastering the art of chopsticks. And I think Marion was a little bit homesick because in the postcard she wrote, "No turkey for us this Thanksgiving." All right, agronomists, pay attention. This is about you. This is Lake George, a large lake in upstate New York, 32 miles long, 200 feet deep at its deepest, and over 170 islands on the lake. Beautiful lake. Steep mountainsides surround the lake for most of its coastline. And if you look at the very top of the picture, you'll see Ticonderoga. And at Ticonderoga, Lake George flows into the southern basin of Lake Champlain. Well, the reason I show the slide is because of an environmental battle that was going on Lake George and had been going on for decades. And the problem was that the water levels were fluctuating hugely, and it was not a natural phenomenon. At Ticonderoga, they had a paper mill. And the folks who ran the paper mill used the waters of Lake George however they wished. So sometimes the water was very, very high and caused extraordinary erosion. And sometimes it was very, very low. As you can see with this poor slob, he's trying to bring his rowboat up to the dock and he's, you know, having to drag it through 10 meters of mud just to get it close to the dock. So this was a huge problem, but there were political concerns. And both Langer and Apperson fought this. The people at the paper mill were well connected. Eventually, John Apperson published a book which was very successful in publicizing the problem, Lake Georgia Mill Pond. And you can see just the destruction of the shoreline, which is why they were so involved in riprapping with rocks. But eventually, after a few decades, they were successful. And they had state legislation that was passed that told the paper mill, you must regulate the level of the lake within these parameters. It can be no lower than this, it can be no higher than that. And even though the paper mill doesn't exist anymore, New York State still does the same thing. Of course, sometimes it's hard to anticipate if you have, it depends on rainfall, and of course you can let more water out of the lake, but you can't put more water into the lake. But that's a picture of Langer measuring levels, and he's actually sitting on the edge of the dam in Ticonderoga. World War II rolls around, and the concern for the military is smoke screens. And together, Langer and Schaefer developed much more effective smoke screens than the military had been using. They were 400 times as effective. And they actually did a test. They flooded an entire valley, the Schoharie Valley near Schenectady, one morning. And the military was blown away. And these smoke screens went on to be used in warfare, of course, very, very effective. Oh, by the way, it was nothing exotic. The material that they used to generate the smoke screens was 30-weight motor oil. So these screens, tremendously effective. They were used to conceal the movements of the American troops across the Rhine in invading Germany, and also in the Pacific to conceal ships. And after these smoke screens were started to be used, the number of successful kamikaze attacks on U.S. warships dropped to zero. You can't fight what you can't see. Towards the end of the war, another problem was the icing of airplane wings. The United States was actually contemplating invading Japan through the Aleutian Islands. But they were worried that the planes would fall out of the sky because the icing on the wings. Now, Langer decides to do some research on this. So he picks a small research station on the top of Mount Washington in New Hampshire. Now, if you know anything about Mount Washington in New Hampshire, it has the worst weather in the world. But Langer thought this was preferable to building a costly wind tunnel. So here we are. Langer's now 63, and he's hiking up and down Mount Washington in the winter, sometimes in crampons, sometimes in skis, again, tremendously fit. And he says something that, of course, only my grandfather would say. He says, Mount Washington, in the winter, has a wonderful climate. The average temperature is minus 5 degrees Fahrenheit, and the wind velocity is about 60 miles per hour average. So I have a motion picture film of the team he was working with, guys literally being blown across the top of the mountain. It was brutal. So the studies were interesting. They learned a lot about water droplet sizes and icing, supercooling. But the problem is, it's not a contained closed system like a light bulb is or a cathode ray tube is. The conditions were unpredictable. They couldn't control them. But Langer makes a prescient remark on one of their hikes. And he says, look, Vince, with all these clouds everywhere, they were surrounded by clouds. There's only a snowflake here and a snowflake there. He said, why? He said, I think we ought to do some more studies on that. It didn't make sense to him that you could be in such a super cooled environment, well below freezing, and surrounded by clouds, but it wasn't snowing much. They got back to that later. World War II ends with a bang, or rather two big bangs. with the two atomic bombs being dropped on Japan. And Langer was, although he was not involved in atomic bomb research, he was very affected by the ramifications of this nuclear weapon. And together, he was in on a series of essays which came together at the end of 1946, fascinating book called One World or None. And you can see foreword by Niels Bohr, introduction by Compton, Oppenheimer, Einstein, Langer. And I just read this book last summer, and I highly recommend it. Some of the essays are a bit dated, but most are still as relevant today as they were then. What he was trying to do was prevent, what all of them were trying to do was, first of all, eliminate even the idea of using nuclear weapons in warfare, but also to prevent an arms race. They were successful on one of those fronts, obviously. And then in 1946, Schaefer figures out how to change those clouds into snow. Langer had gone on vacation. The war was over. He was in the Southwest enjoying some sunny weather, perhaps in Arizona, who knows. But he gave Schaefer an assignment. He said, listen, I want you to start generating clouds in a cold box, which was nothing more than a General Electric deep freezer. And Schaefer would breathe into this box, generate some clouds, and then he tried all different kinds of solid materials. He tried calcium carbonate, he tried lycopodium powder, he tried all these different things, and none of them worked. Now, it was July, it was hot in Schenectady, and one day he couldn't get the freezer cold enough. So, in frustration, he went and got a piece of dry ice. And when he put the dry ice into the freezer, all of a sudden, the cloud changed completely to ice crystals. And that was the famous cold box experiment that led to cloud seeding. Famous picture, there's Schaefer leaning over, breathing into the box, Langer leaning over, looking intently. And a new man on the team, who they grabbed from the chemistry department to help them, that's Bernie Vonnegut. Bernie Vonnegut was Kurt Vonnegut, the author's, his brother. And Vonnegut contributed his bit to cloud seeding. Flipping through a handbook of physics one day, he noticed that the crystallography of silver iodide was very similar to ice. So as a result, they had a chemical that they could use at room temperature to seed clouds that was even more effective than dry ice. So then the research went on in earnest. This was a very exciting time. But of course, we're still in the summer, so you can't go out seeding super cooled clouds. It's too warm. Now, General Electric at this point realizes the liability issues involved here. If you can see clouds and you can make it rain, that's great, but what if you cause flooding? And what if those floods lead to deaths or property damage? And as a result, General Electric was very relieved to have the military take over the project. And GE was out of it. But Langer and Schaefer were still kept on as the key consultants. The other problem was commercial cloud seeding. And I should mention they were successful in November with field tests with cloud seeding. They seeded a cloud over Mount Greylock in Massachusetts, and all of a sudden this stratus cloud, they made it snow. Very exciting discovery. The problem was commercial seeders muddied the waters, which leads me to one of my favorite cartoons. This is the New Yorker. Priests are standing there and they're saying, looking at the rainstorm, I wonder if it's theirs or ours. The seeding experiments, Langer wanted to have a controlled experiment because it's, of course, very hard to control any experiments in the atmosphere. And so we set up a weekly seeding in Socorro, New Mexico, And as a result, for almost 2 years, it rained every Tuesday in the Ohio Valley, and 2 days later in New England. Now, you can never truly prove cause and effect, of course, because it's an open system, but Langer did the statistics, strong statistical correlation. And boy, did it piss off the Weather Bureau. They were so upset because this chemist and his team of chemists and physicists had come in and done an end run around the Weather Bureau. These guys didn't have degrees in meteorology. What the heck were they doing stepping on our toes? Also, in 1950, Langer retired. Now, when I say he retired, that means he still kept an office at General Electric and went in a lot, but just not as often as he did. And in 1953, he delivered a very famous lunchtime talk called Pathological Science. And this was an idea that came to him because he'd seen so much bad science over the years. Having Langer point out an error, and this was often at a conference, was like having a boulder land on you. He was not shy about pointing out sloppy science. One of his favorites, he went after the speed of the deer fly. The author had asserted that a deer fly flies at 700 miles an hour because its path is blurred. Langer carried a small lead weight on a string in his vest pocket and would spin it around until it got a blur, and he calculated the speed as about 30 miles an hour. And another one he went after was extrasensory perception when it was first brought out. Professor Rhine down at Duke University. Langer went down and met with Rhine and discovered that, yeah, his results were very impressive, the ones he'd published, but Rhine had actually ignored tons of results because they didn't support his hypothesis. And eventually Langer is slowing down. Here we see him at his island home, enjoying a little fun time with the dogs. And he was just getting ready to publish a huge paper on the energy budget of Lake George, energy flow in and out of the lake. And sadly had a massive heart attack and died a few days later. An amazing career. Over 200 papers published during his career, 15 honorary degrees, 20 science awards. Just an incredible life. And he passed it on well. Quick plug for the video. I promise to be fast. Won a few awards. Was invited to Sundance Film Festival as well. It was shown on PBS. It's playing all afternoon. Please come by and check it out. And also it has a splendid interview with Kurt Vonnegut as well. And so what I'll do is I'll just finish with some recommended reading. These are all wonderful books about Langer and what he did. And with that, I believe I'm finished. Thank you for your kind attention today.